How do we nurture creative, connected, resilient, emotionally intelligent, and empowered children? And they say it takes a village. So if you're feeling overwhelmed by the responsibility, you're not alone. I believe we can change the narrative for our children, but to do that, we need to change our story. Hello, it's great to have you with me. I'm Kim Clyden, former ABC radio presenter and children's book author, creating a community of people who care about children. Have you ever looked back on the path you've walked and it all begins to make perfect sense? Not because it went as planned, but because every experience has been preparing us for something deeper. Today is about one of those stories. You may even recognise my guest from her work in film, television, theatre and radio. A storyteller, a performer, a voice that has entertained and connected audiences for decades. But this conversation isn't about being in the spotlight. It's about what happens after. Somewhere between scripts, studios and seasons of creative work, Gabby Milgate found herself barefoot in the rainforest, swimming in rivers, reconnecting with something many of us forget as we grow older, our relationship and connection with nature. Gabby is the nature pedagogy leader at Woden Valley Early Learning Centre in Canberra, the first role of its kind in the Australian Capital Territory. And as president of the Australian Association for Environmental Education, ACT, she's helping shape a national movement that children are not too young to understand the world. They're already in relationship with it. Through her work, Gabby is reimagining early childhood spaces, not as places of containment and compliance, but as living, breathing environments where children can explore, connect, and contribute. You know, nature isn't a luxury. It's actually a human right. And in a world facing climate uncertainty, perhaps the most important question we can ask is, what do we teach our children about the earth they will inherit? Gabby, I'm so glad you're here. What do you remember about your early childhood?
Mum and Dad separated when I was five, and then Dad moved to Sydney. So he'd do stuff like take us snorkelling at Clovelly, and Mum would always make sure we had a Christmas holiday at the beach. And she'd always say to me, go on an adventure. And I'd be like, oh, I don't know what to do. But it was beautiful at Browlea on the south coast of New South Wales. I loved watching the little crabs, the blue-shelled crabs, come out of their holes when the tide was low. And I loved swimming in the ocean and going out as far as I could. But growing up, there were definitely high expectations, because my mum was a single mum working full-time and doing a uni degree so that she could improve her and our prospects.
We often look as modern parenting as the ones who are all working and trying to manage and juggle families, but I grew up in a household where my parents were running a business and we were coming home to an empty house when I was finally allowed, you know, like at the age of 10. Before that, we were having to go to my parents' business every afternoon after school. So what do you think the biggest difference is today, considering you remember your childhood and your mum working and holidays with your dad, in relation to the way early childhood is for many? Because obviously working in that environment, you must see a heap of parents who are torn between having to work and spending time with their child.
Yeah, I think, you know, we were the latchkey kids. So I'm 55 this year. So, yeah, I was coming home as well and making things like brown sugar on toast under the griller.
Love it. I wish I'd known that recipe.
So definitely left to my own devices, probably didn't have good health outcomes for me. But, you know, that's just the way it was. And now we have parents, often single parents, who live in apartments where the only access to nature children have is at an early learning service like ours, where we have beautiful gardens, spaces for them to dig, chickens and ducks, food to find and take home to share with their family.
You mentioned you were an actress. The most notable movie people will recognise you from is obviously Muriel's Wedding and that famous line, which I'm sure you're sick of hearing now, but you have named...
Yeah.
I love it.
Or do you want to say it?
Sure. You're terrible, Muriel.
It's just like this famous iconic, because, you know, it doesn't matter who I talk to, that's how they remember you, that's how they know you, that's how they first encountered you. But that's not your whole story, even though one of the ducks at Woden Valley called Muriel. I love that you've had a career as, you know, an actress, you're a comedian, like you crack me up all the time. And you also had a career at ABC, which was how we met. So yeah. You know, how would you describe your career trajectory that's brought you to this point?
Well, your terrible Muriel is a phrase that immediately connects me with Australians. And it's sort of like that little foot in the door that allows me to put the message that I want to share with Australia, which is children are so capable of connecting and contributing to the world and even contributing to the community's broader sustainability goals. It mightn't be in the way you imagine. It's more than teaching them what the recycling bin is. It's just giving them access and agency so that they're learning, while 90% of brain development's happening in the first 5 years, what the world is made of. And I'm sure if I'd had those experiences beyond bark and a sandpit, that I would have known how to have an adventure as I was growing up.
When did you recognise the importance of nature pedagogy in early childcare?
Well, I started out as a trainee when I transitioned from showbiz to doing something where I just wanted to be useful. So I was indoors, upstairs all day with two-year-olds, and they had outdoor-style rooms. And that was just very, very difficult because you've got big emotions, you've got children with developmental needs to push and pull and climb. So we spent a lot of the day going, I'm sorry, I can't let you do that, that's not safe. Please don't push your friend, all of those sorts of things, and then the big emotions. But working now for 10 years in environments where children can go outside, regulate their emotions on cool grass, on a shady tree, feed the chickens and the ducks, push and pull on logs and rocks, and they can dig and use all that climbing up a tree. You know, you can't have outdoor-style rooms and expect children to develop ecological literacy skills or even develop properly. So the reason why my service transitioned to nature play is the parents recognised that their children were experiencing nature deficit disorder, so developmental delays, emotional dysregulation, all of those things. So they added one more person to the team, which was me, and now, like, the benefits is just so astounding and beautiful. And I discovered that first by just transforming space with the children. And I discovered, oh, when they know about it, when they're involved with it, when they're knowledgeable and confident, they're not ripping it apart and destroying it. They're looking after it and they're eating from it. And even children who didn't like eating vegetables would eat and cook the beans that they found. Like, they still didn't like the taste, but they really enjoyed eating it.
I love that. That's the perfect sort of scenario, I suppose, because children are invested in something that they've assisted to grow. I mean, this is what children want. They want responsibility. They want to understand how they can do things autonomously. So, yay, I'm celebrating you. Now, I had never heard of Nature Pedagogy Leader until I saw you release your book of chickens in early childhood. Yes. Love that title. God, you're so funny. How did this come about? Is this something you actually made up? I mean, why is your centre the only one that's really leading in this space?
I think it's because it's hard to provide ecological assurance when educators themselves aren't that confident with the natural world. They might not have been brought up themselves. And also, there's so much put upon educators these days. Everything gets kicked down the road for educators to fix. You know, if you're working in a room, there's so much to be responsible for that adding, oh, and make sure that they have all the skills they need so that they can be up to the task demands of climate change, adaption and resilience. It's just like, oh, we can put some seeds on some cotton wool, you know. And so the need for a nature pedagogy leader hasn't been explicitly expressed in the form of children's rights, and also in light of Australia's first risk assessment, which came out in September 2025, which predicts what our futures are going to be like across many domains, like the economy, the environment, well-being and health, all of those things. And they're all hitting the extreme end of the scale. So these children are going to be inheriting climate change consequences. So it's up to someone who's been in a service that has done it for 10 years to go, hey, you could use us as a model of how services can transition and how you're going to be designing new builds, which is happening at the moment with the $1 billion that Jason Clare, the education minister's, announced with Jess Walsh, who's the early childhood education minister.
Well, that's really interesting, Gabby, because they are actually overhauling the entire system because of the recent crisis in childcare. Given that they had this opportunity to recreate and reinvent the entire system, which is sadly lacking in so many areas, what's your proposal in relation to how they should be building from the ground up?
Well, the first thing I'd say is that we need a nature pedagogy leader in every service to help services transition. Not only do I make sure that children are developing ecological literacy skills and have access to natural affordances within their environments, but I'm also a first responder when things go a little bit unexpectedly pear-shaped. So say an educator has to go to home sick, which means two educators are needed to change nappies. So they just ring me, I step in and I'm like outside with a bag of seed and dirt with the children, so that the functioning of children's needs within the room can still happen. So in that way, I'm a first responder. In the national quality frameworks, the quality area 3 means a service is fit for purpose. And so what I'm saying is our fit for purpose needs to be through the lens of what we know is coming down the line because of what we've been told in Australia's first climate risk assessment. So what skills do we want children to have? We want to get them ready for school, but we also want to get them ready for life on a shared planet. I mean, it says in the EYLF, the Early Years Learning Framework, and the National Quality Standards that services and educators attend to all aspects of the environment. That's a lot to undertake without a nature pedagogy leader making sure that that happens. And how do we assess if children are the beneficiaries of these? And it's not just rhetoric. It's not just going, this is the way it should be. How are we reporting on that? How are we assessing that? So I've created tools. So I've created an Access to Nature survey and asked children the questions. Have you played with a stick? Have you played with a rock? Who gives you access to nature? Do you do water play? But really simple questions, and then a service can assess themselves and add to their quality improvement plan. So I'm not asking for new infrastructure. I'm just asking for one more person to be added to the team. Already we have a regulation 118 that requires services to have an educational leader, but you need somebody who understands the contemporary research around the benefits of nature play for children. And those are children experience more well-being, 3 years of access to nature in early learning settings improves academic outcomes, and on and on and on. That's the contemporary understanding. And this is what I'm trying to communicate to stakeholders in children's well-being, like education ministers, UNICEF, and the Children's Commissioner. So it's just one little bit we're missing from the system.
Last year, I attended the only event that I'm aware of where 11 and 12-year-olds actually take to the stage as keynote speakers for a two-day conference. It's called the Childhood Summit, which is led by Hayano Moser, the CEO of Play Australia. The one thing that just boggles my mind is that we have all of this research. We have a UN Charter of Human Rights that states that children have that right to play, that right to expression, and yet we don't seem to be honouring it. So how can we move this along?
Well, because UNICEF has been interested in me briefing them, because the Children's Commissioner, the new Children's Commissioner, is interested in me briefing these things, that tells me that we're missing implementation strategy. And because there's so much research being done, there's not the money spent on actually putting people in services so that the results of this research can be actioned. So we need to action it now. Like, we can't keep doing more research. Like, what's the point? Because it's not being actioned. We need to be, we've got the research from the last 30 years. We've had some of the top academics in Australia informing these fantastic EYLF and NQS, national quality standards, regulations, all of those sorts of things. But there's been no guidance on how to action it. It's always been left up to educators or services that are particularly interested. This is a national issue. If we want our population to be able to manage the climate crisis and create all these little geniuses are going to come up with these amazing solutions to the problems we have today, we've got to start when 90% of brain development happens.
Yes, in early childhood. Now, this isn't just a national problem, though. I mean, you've travelled to New Zealand last year. You're in touch with education leaders from around the globe. I mean, looking at it globally, who's actually getting it right?
Oh, Norway. And, you know, those countries, they're proof of concept right there. But we need an Australian nature pedagogy approach, because we've got such extreme temperatures here in Australia, and every service is different depending on where they're located. But at the very baseline, children need to be taught ecological literacy. And what I mean by that can be summed up in a little song. Can I sing it for you?
I'd love that, and I'm sure my listeners would too.
You might know the tune. It goes like this. Dirt, mud, rock, stick, seed, plant, bean, worm, bugs, logs, early learning keys, curious, tree UV, rainbow news, we're young and free. Now I know ecology, next time won't you share with me?
You're amazing, Gabby Milgate. Honestly, your brain, I'd like to study it, but we'll probably have to wait until you pass.
It might be empty and just gets filled with inspiration daily.
It is not a vacuum up there.
We sucking in all the good stuff. We created that song at Woden so that children could have a voice at COP31, because children birth to five, people don't know how to get their opinion. So that's why I created the Access to Nature survey. People don't know how to give children a voice. I mean, recently I read CEO of Good Start was reporting on the inquiry into the early childhood crisis in Parliament. And these parliamentary leaders just think early childhood education is so that parents can go to work, you know, essentially saying they're entertainment and containment facilities until we, you know, conveyor belt them off to primary school, which we're putting right next to them. So that's the image of the child. That's the understanding of human development is lacking within decision-making population. The contemporary understanding of human development, as I've said, is 90% of brain development happens in the first 5 years. That's where you learn cooperation, emotional regulation, working with rights and responsibilities. And that brings again, how are we actioning the Uluru Statement from the heart? That we're going to care for country. So all of those things come under nature pedagogy. And if we have a nature pedagogy assurance within the regulatory body of CEQA, then we can get the ball rolling on services going, oh, this is important, because it's up to service providers to provide the environment so that educators can do their job. When you think play spaces, traditional play spaces in early learning, sandpit, metal climbing frames, softball, fake grass. That's not teaching ecological literacy. That's a waiting room for climate grief. We want to take children into the future by going, I know and I can, rather than, I don't know, I can't. You know, because that's how we feel. That's how we, the population of Australia grew up, feeling like, I don't know, I can't do anything. But what I want to reassure people is with this idea from physicist Ilya, I can't pronounce his name, but he's a physicist. He said, when a system is far from equilibrium, small islands of coherence have the capacity to shift the entire system. So if we want to shift the entire system of how we have a relationship with country rather than it just being a resource, rather than it just be something we put our houses on and our, drive our cars on, if we want to do that, we want to start with these small islands of coherence within an early learning service. And not only will you get an ecologically literate population, but you'll have predicted drops in obesity, mental health issues, on and on and on. And I've done the calculations. Over 10 years, you'll get a 5,000 return on investment, 5,000%. So something like for every dollar spent, you'll get 60 back, or over the lifetime of a child of this population, 27 billion.
Oh, that just blows my mind.
But not doing it is going to cost a lot more, because we'll still have the problems and we'll still have, yeah, well, you know, children have all these rights and, you know, it's in the frameworks and all of that, but we'll have no way to action it. So everybody listen to me and do what I say.
I love that call to action, Gabby.
Yeah, but it's worked at Woden and we're just trying to share what works for us. And we think it's replicable. And so does Community Early Learning Australia. So they're the peak body for community early learning services. And they advocate to government. And they want to use Woden as a model for how new services are built.
Not just new services. I think we need to be thinking about that as a retrofitting of old services as well, because they're clearly not working. They're not serving our children or their parents. I was having a discussion with Anna Noon recently, who's the co-founder of the Groundswell Collective. She's planting tennis court size tiny forests to address some of these issues you've raised. So if you think you can find a few tennis courts in Canberra, maybe I can hook you up with her and you and the kids can go out and plant some tiny forests.
What I want to be doing is transforming environments with the children. So that, I mean, when you're talking about what early learning services are missing at the moment, I get all a bit excited because I'm like, oh, you could transform it with the children. And in doing so, you give children the impression that they can connect and contribute to their world, that they can care for country, and that they understand what the world is made of and can make a difference in that world. So I find that all very exciting, because that's what happened at Woden. We had traditional play spaces, and we transformed it with the children, one small project at a time. That's why I think this is achievable and doable and implementable. What I'd like to do is create a Jerusalem artichoke maze. So Jerusalem artichoke, they look like ginger. They're a tuber that grows in the ground and they cook like potato. But in the growing season, they can grow up to like 3 meters tall and create this green, cool space in summer. And then the children rip them up and dig them up when they're ready to harvest. And then we play with the sticks, which are really light. So the stalks that they grow, they dry out. And inside is something like the inside of a texture, like a kind of natural styrofoam. So they're really light. The perfect thing to give children to play with as sticks. And, you know, stick play, amongst other things, teaches mathematical concepts, et cetera, et cetera. There's all sorts of benefits with that. But they love finding things in the ground, and then they get to take them home and share with their family. They have as many calories as corn per acre. So as, you know, food shortages are predicted because of climate change consequences. We need to be setting up early learning services as possible, supply chain mitigation hubs so that we're starting to develop soils now so that if we do need to plant food to help, you know, give families fresh fruit and vegetables, that's available. But we have to start first with the children transforming the environments and then build that up over time.
Yeah, we also have to make sure we've got enough water to grow food in the future because it is a finite resource that we do not take care of enough. Gabby Milgate, this is your final chance to give me a call to action for all those people listening. What as individuals can we do to support you in using Woden Valley as a model that can be replicated throughout the nation?
Well, if you want your early learning service to give your children the skills they're going to need to be up to the task demands of climate change mitigation and resilience, speak to your early learning service and say, this is the contemporary understanding of best practice for children's development and long-term safety, not just immediate safety, but long-term safety. Start having that conversation with your early learning service. Another thing you could do is write to Kate Thwaites. She's the special envoy for climate change mitigation and resilience out of Department of Climate Change, Energy and Water. When I wrote to Chris Bowen, they sent me to her. So the can's been kicked down the road to her. And yeah, just get in touch with me at Woden Valley Early Learning Centre on Facebook, or there's a million ways to find me.
I know, and I'll be sharing a lot of that in the show notes of this episode. Gabby, thank you so much for sharing your very important message. I, for one, would like to secure a future for my great-grandchildren and will be doing all I can, including maybe taking it up with Kate Thwaites. So I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Kimmy.
I feel really hopeful after that conversation with Gabby Milgate. She's a nature pedagogy leader at Woden Valley Early Learning in Canberra. Gabby's work is challenging the way we think about early education. If our children are given the opportunity to care for the land, to grow food, understand ecosystems, and connect with Indigenous knowledge systems, they don't just learn about the world, they'll have a place in it. And that's where the real change begins. Now, if this conversation has resonated with you, I encourage you to share it with someone in your world. As an educator, a parent, a carer, any guardian, someone who influences children in the world. Because these ideas, they don't happen in isolation. They grow when we pass them on. Thank you so much for joining me and Gabby today. This is What We Teach Our Children, and I'm Kim Clyden. And the smallest lessons can create the biggest impact. Until we're together again, let's be the change we want to see in the world.